Hi, and welcome to the Friday Coffee Meetup podcast for Friday, October 4th, 2019. On today's episode, we'll hear from Ezra Callahan, co-founder of Arrive Hotels and Restaurants, on scaling meaningful company culture.
The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory, a Pasadena-based marketing and advertising agency that specializes helping healthcare, consumer goods, clean tech, and aerospace companies achieve rapid, sustainable growth. Echo Factory CEO Mike Schaefer is a co-founder and organizer of Friday Coffee Meetup. If you're interested in how Echo Factory can help your company achieve rapid, sustainable growth, you can learn more at echo-factory.com. Every week, the Friday Coffee Meetup brings together innovators, startups, investors, tech companies, and entrepreneurs at the cross-campus co-working space in Pasadena. You can learn about upcoming meetups and how you can attend in person at fridaycoffeemeetup.com.
Now, here's Ezra Callahan with this week's presentation.
Hopefully can live up to that hype. My name is Ezra Callahan. I wanted to talk about company culture. It's a topic I've experienced a lot. It's one that I'm finding is becoming more and more relevant just with the way the working world is going. It's one companies are paying more and more attention to, and it's becoming a more important part of the working world, and I'll talk some about why I think that's happening. And probably the main thesis here that I want to impart is that culture, I think, traditionally was something people thought of as sort of a passive thing. It just was what it was. And I think the message I would put out is that for those of you founding companies, you know, the entrepreneurs out there, those of you, you know, just workers thinking about where do you want to work, and also for investors when you're looking at companies and assessing them, that company culture is now one of those linchpins that needs as much attention, thought, research, and intention about it as almost anything else that a company does. Give you a little background on myself. So I'm actually a native of Pasadena, grew up here. Was a lifer over at Poly. They had pre-K back then, so I went there from pre-K through 12. I went up north for college, went to Stanford, majored in an interdisciplinary program they have there called Symbolic Systems. Fancy name, it's really just cognitive science mixed with computer science. It's actually one of the more popular majors there now because a bunch of computer science would-be majors realized that instead of taking physics and engineering, in addition to their computer science, they could take humanities. So it mixes philosophy, psychology, linguistics. The idea behind it was for people interested in artificial intelligence, human-computer interaction, this realization that a purely engineering education didn't set you up great for those topics, that if you're going to work on artificial intelligence, you need to actually be able to think about what is intelligence, which means, you know, you got to read John Locke, and you got to read Hume, and you got to read those folks. And if you're going to work on natural language processing, you need to actually study the science of language. And if you're going to work on human-computer interaction, you need to think about how do people work, not just how do computers work, and take some psychology. So a really cool program. You actually see a lot of leaders at Facebook, but also around the Valley, have actually come out of that program. When I graduated Stanford, didn't really know what I wanted to do with myself. Got a job on campus my first year out. Got a house nearby with a few friends who were either finishing up or doing other things in the area. And we had an extra bedroom, so we emailed around to some list we knew to see who might need a place, and got a response from this guy named Sean Parker. And my friend who was sort of handling this looked it up and was like, I think it's that Sean Parker, like the co-founder of Napster, and we were looking at this, if that doesn't make any sense. But we met him, and he ended up moving in with us and realized it actually made sense because co-founder of Napster is a big name, but you didn't make any money off of Napster. And he was at his second startup at the time, sort of a business, a virtual business card that now sort of sounds quaint, this company called Plaxo, but at the time was actually the only ones doing this, you know, really a predecessor to LinkedIn and almost every other type of corporate social networking out there. Very early, almost probably too early, was probably their problem. So likewise, you know, he was one of those guys that was a paper millionaire, a term you would hear in the Valley a lot back then, that worth a lot on paper but had $0 in his bank account. So of course he needed to live with five random early 20-somethings in a house. We all lived together for that year. End of that year, I still didn't know what to do with myself. So like a good Jewish boy, I decided I was just going to go to law school. Decided I was just going to travel until I was out of money, and then was just going to go live at my parents' house back here in Pasadena until law school started. And was just reaching that point where out of nowhere I got an email from Sean Parker, who in the 4 months since we'd all moved out of the house had somehow become the president of Facebook, asked me what I was doing. Luckiest point in my life that I was doing absolutely nothing. So he said, why don't you come work for Facebook? And I said, sure, I've got 6 months to kill, why not? Literally threw my stuff in my car, drove up there. I guess I'll tell this story. Sean had not, I think he had mentioned in passing to Mark Zuckerberg and Dustin Moskovitz that he had hired me, but not in any great detail. Had not mentioned that he had offered that I could go crash at the house they were working out of. It was still a living room operation at the time. So I showed up at their door at like 12:30 at night, you know, with all my stuff. Dustin answered the door. I was sort of like, who are you? And I was like, I'm Ezra. I work for you. And he's like, oh, cool. And then he's sort of still looking at me and follow up with, and Sean said I could crash here. Inconveniently, Sean wasn't there. He was out on a date. Fortunately, he got home about 45 minutes later, explained things, smoothed it over. But I then spent the next 6.5 years at Facebook. I joined in late 2004. I was the sixth employee. There were five of us living in that house and one guy down in San Jose racking servers as fast as they could buy them. When I first started, did pretty much everything, did a little bit of coding, sold some ads, did some organizational stuff. You know, I was one of only two employees who was over 21, so buying beer was a critical part of my job. I was the second oldest person at the company when I started at 23. I realized even when I, you know, my fourth year at the company, I was still in the oldest third of the company in my mid-late 20s, just to give you a sense of what was this company like. Eventually, we decided what I was doing was product management, so I became the first product manager. But over time, what I found was with how rapidly the company was developing and how rapidly it was growing, very quickly, my biggest asset at the company was my longevity there. And that sounds funny to say, but you know, by 2008, all of the other co-founders had left. I was the most tenured employee at the company besides Mark Zuckerberg. And so over time, my role at the company became be the most tenured employee at the company who's not named Mark Zuckerberg. And so I found myself working less on individual projects and initially working on coordination between different teams, initially within the product engineering organization that was working on the website and the technology, and then over time drifted even more towards the middle and started an internal communications team there, which blows my mind. I met, he left a couple months ago, but met the current person in that role at a wedding randomly that had a mutual friend, and found out he has a team of like 25 people now, and I'm like, wow, it was just me, you know, running around trying to do all this on my own, trying to convince people this was a real function. But basically put myself at a role where it was focused on information flow within the company, that when you have a company that's moving this rapidly and had the culture that it had, which we'll talk about, you really needed to actively manage that. And so for my last 2 years at Facebook, my role was really helping cultivate and shepherd. I don't want to say drive because the culture there was its own beast, but to really try to help keep it going in a positive direction and keep it aligned with what the company was actually trying to do. I'll come back to talk about Facebook a lot because obviously that informed a lot about this topic for me. But after Facebook hit a point where I just sort of hit a wall, which I think a lot of people working at that company, especially in the early days, hit. It was a lifestyle. It was 24/7. I mean, between the work being 24/7 and everyone being young and the same age, and you know, we all lived together, we hung out together, everyone was friends with each other. The way we recruited was basically you would just hire your friends to come work at the company. The largest group at Facebook was what was called user operations, was basically just dealing user support. We had like the most educated user support team ever because we would just hire our friends, the people already there, which were mostly Stanford, Harvard, and other at Berkeley and other schools like that, would just bring in our friends who are graduating. So, you know, 2 years in, it kind of looked like, imagine your freshman dorm running a company, and that's kind of what it felt like. My wife worked at Facebook. We're one of, like, probably 30 or 40 couples who met and got married there. We have four Facebook babies. There's this whole generation of kids born to people who met and got married working at Facebook. So I basically just hit this wall of, you know, I needed a life that was not defined by this company anymore. Moved back to Southern California, kind of fell back into that point of, you know, not sure what to do with myself again. Lived downtown. I had a friend who had grown up in LA who was like, you got to come check out downtown. You know, the 10 years I was up north, downtown LA became a thing. And he was like, come check it out. It's crazy what's happening here. He was a lawyer who was ready to not be a lawyer anymore. So we were kind of at the same place at the same time and just started pursuing random ideas for bars, restaurants, cool ideas we had. Ended up getting involved in a music venue in downtown. Got involved in some properties in the Arts District. We sort of timed it right of the Arts District was sort of really becoming a thing, and got involved in some projects there. And then happened to meet these two guys in the hospitality industry who had been spitballing an idea for a new hotel brand. They had met at Four Seasons and then gone off to their own careers. And it was one of those, they'd stayed friends. And it was kind of that impression of if you ever have someone where it's like, you amp each other out about an idea, you swear you're going to do it, and then nothing happens in that sort of 2 or 3 year cycle. I think we just happened to meet them at a time where they were sort of at peak, amped up about this idea, and we really liked it and got to talking with them about it, and 2 or 3 months in decided, you know what, let's just try this, and went and built a hotel in Palm Springs just to prototype this brand idea. It was called Arrive. It's this idea of a hyper-local hotel. Treat a hotel like a public space. So physically and spiritually, build it around local-facing restaurants, bars, retail, and open spaces. That idea got traction, and suddenly other people wanted to develop hotels with us. And so within about a year of Palm Springs opening, was fully focused on that. And so now that's my full-time gig is Arrive Hotels and Restaurants. We've opened our second and third hotels earlier this summer. Our fourth and fifth hotels will be opening in the next 2 months. And then we have about, on any given day, 4 to 6 projects going off in the future. And what was interesting is building the second company, taking these lessons from company culture and applying them to a completely different world, completely different mindset, and really being able to sort of triangulate what really matters. What are the challenges? What works? You know, what is industry specific? What is company specific? And what are the broad parameters that apply across the board? So kind of going back to what is company culture, like what, you know, like I said, that it's an intentional thing. You know, early on at Facebook, I remember when we first started talking about culture and managing culture, it bothered me because, you know, the 24-year-old version of me was culture just is what it is. And the moment you try to start steering it or managing it or anything along those lines, it becomes contrived and artificial. I'm going to talk shit about Google for a second here, but it was one of those things that when Facebook was coming up, Google was the pinnacle of culture in the Silicon Valley and in some respects nationwide. It had drawn so much attention for it. But what we were looking at is with Google, it was a lot of the things that early on defined the culture had become commoditized in a weird way. It was you wear silly hats around the office, you know, the offices look weird, you don't sit in normal chairs. Like the quirkiness had become contrived in some respect. And it felt like in talking with people who were coming over from there, it was because it was sort of being pushed on you. It was no longer this organic thing that had just come up from this is just the nature of the people working here, and it had organically turned into this to now it was, oh, this is our thing, we're going to own this, and now we've said it's our thing, and now we're imparting this on everyone. And so my reaction then was, that's really artificial, that's not real, it's not genuine, that's not culture, that's, you know, internal branding, and we should never want that. And then as my role evolved and I moved more towards the middle of Facebook and this idea of centralized you know, the problems that culture was creating and the problems the company needed addressed through culture, realized what Google was doing was not just necessary, but was the right thing. There were elements of it that we could learn from that we might want to do differently, but that culture is in fact something that is as goal-oriented and purposeful and intentional as the product you're working on, as your mission, all of these things, that it didn't make it meaningless by managing it and really thinking about it and being very thoughtful about it. So if you think of kind of from the company's perspective, what role does culture play? These are the things that really jump out at me. I mean, the most obvious one is sort of the motivational aspect that companies with strong cultures make people care. And that was Facebook's biggest strength, was how much people from the employee perspective, it's this idea of meaning in what you're doing, and I'll talk more about that in a second. From the company's perspective, you would look at it as drinking the Kool-Aid. Can you get your employees to drink the Kool-Aid? And Facebook's biggest internal strength since day one has been getting people to chug the Kool-Aid and buy into this, even as today where it's, I don't even know how many employees they have now, 50, 600,000. I don't know what they have these days. Still, you know, how thoroughly everyone there buys into what the company is doing and buys into this idea that there's this greater meaning to what they're doing. So back to that side of it, I think that's a big cultural change that is not going away, that people demand that their professional life give as much meaning to their life as their personal life. You talk to our parents, grandparents, that generation, it was almost the opposite, where work was what you did to put food on the table. The meaning you got, you know, it was not a place for meaning. It was not a place for growth or depth. It was really singularly focused on enabling that stuff in your personal life with your family life. And now it's clear that everybody views what you do to make money is as meaningful, should be creating as much meaning and fulfillment for yourself as your family, as your hobbies, as your church, whatever else you're doing. And so that motivational aspect of company culture matters more than ever. And it gets into these next three of productivity. Is your culture helping your employees be more productive? Or on the flip side, something we very often ran into at Facebook, is your culture actually making people less productive? It's great when you have a very social, open culture, but when everyone's hungover every morning the next day, that's sort of the most blunt force. Maybe your culture is not as aligned with productivity as it should be. But there's other elements too, how your company communicates internally, how transparent is it? Transparency is probably the biggest word around productivity as far as culture goes. Does your company have healthy levels of transparency? Even in industries where transparency is a tricky thing, you know, even if you work at a law firm where you can't exactly be transparent, or if you're in a tech firm where the IP is very, very sensitive, you're a company like Palantir where God knows what you're doing and, you know, you can't reveal what you're doing to a lot of the company, how do you still keep people productive and create a culture where people feel like they are part of a company and not, you know, just some cog who's here who's being left out of the key conversations? I don't know if it's still like that, but when we were growing at Facebook, we were getting a ton of people from Apple, where at Apple that had happened, where there was this inner circle of people who were in on it and this long tail of everyone else who was not in on what they were doing. And the culture was great if you were in the circle and terrible if you weren't, which was great for Facebook because there were some very talented people in that outer circle who gravitated towards a company that had these cultural elements that they wanted. So along those lines with retention and recruitment, this is a worker's market. So if you're an investor or a founder, you know, this applies across the board now. Workers increasingly are getting to choose where they work. It's sort of the, from a company perspective, the negative side of zero unemployment is you have to try a lot harder to get people to want to work for you, and you have to try a lot harder to keep people wanting to work for you. And culture is one of the most leveraged things you can use for that, beyond obviously just throwing money and stock and whatever other benefits you want at people. Giving people a place that they feel happy at and want to go to every day is probably the most leveraged thing you can do as far as retention and recruitment go. For a lot of companies, and especially startups, it's kind of the only way you can differentiate yourself in a lot of places where, you know, from a new college grad, a lot of startups look the same. Everyone has a compelling story. Everyone sounds like they're doing something that's cutting edge, that's going to be the next big thing. A lot of times the differentiator is, what's the vibe of this place? What are the people who are here like? Are they happy? Because that, at the end of the day, is one of the only things you have that actually looks different between these places. And that gets into this last bit of loyalty. One of the biggest kind of trailing aspects of having a strong company culture is the goodwill you build with employees. At a company like Facebook, which every other day was creating some kind of scandal out in the world and would be just getting bombarded with bad press, even friends and relatives coming at us, you know, swords out for whatever we had done wrong this time, having a strong culture built this goodwill and this internal loyalty that employees became your first and best line of defense. You rallied the troops, and you still see it today at Facebook that, you know, whatever the latest thing is, you know, this last 2 weeks, I don't know, there's a scandal every day the last 2 weeks that they're going to not apply the same content rules to politicians that they're applying to the general public. Incredible internal debate that I'm getting bits and pieces of spilling out. Really vigorous, really hard internal debate around this. But because the company has the culture that enables that, the end result is everyone then defends the decision, even if they actually vehemently disagree with it, which a lot of people there do. That same thing happened all the time. You know, newsfeed launched. I don't know how many of you were on Facebook back in the early days when it was a college-only website and newsfeed launched, and every college kid in America was furious at the company. Internally, the debate actually went largely the same way. People internally were furious about how we had rolled it out and what it was doing, and it didn't have enough privacy controls. But because we were able to have that debate very openly internally, when it came time to, okay, we've had this debate, now let's deal with many millions of people trying to have the same debate with us, everyone was now on the company's side and defended the company, even if they were at the same time acknowledging that the company had not acted correctly. That same thing, you know, for those, the history of Facebook is well known in the public sphere, that happened over and over and over again. And you wonder, how does a company that is so scandal-ridden and accused of doing such terrible things, like how did the 2016 election not tear that company apart? And the answer comes back to, it's the company's strong culture. It was because it had built a culture that could have those debates internally and have it out internally, and whatever cathartic effect, whatever actually winning people over and explaining the company's position to people, whatever combination of that was, the company then is able to show a pretty united front out to the world and stand behind the company. Whereas you can imagine plenty of examples of other companies where that didn't happen. Uber was one where, you know, the company culture was strong, but maybe hadn't gone in entirely the right direction and hadn't been actively cultivated. It was one where they let the culture be what it was for too long. And as soon as it started hitting a scandal, especially at the top, everyone turned on that. There was none of this, let's rally to defend the leadership. It was throw the leadership under the bus, you know, arguably rightfully so in certain elements of what was happening with that culture. But you can see, you can imagine with a company like Facebook, if it didn't have this strong internal culture with any of these scandals, how quickly that company would have just spiraled and had thousands of employees turning on itself. And it never could have survived that added PR crush of, not only is, you know, our government officials angry or random people angry, now employees have turned against it. That would have been, you know, impossible for the company to overcome. So these are the reasons why, from wearing your company hat, why you should care about this and pay attention to it. It then gets into the question of sort of, how do you go about dealing with it? Which gets back to the original question of, what is culture? I'm not going to give you a good answer on that, partly because I don't think there is one answer to it, and partly because it does vary place to place. It depends a lot on what you're doing. Strong cultures are aligned with what you're doing, which is why I'm sort of starting with this. You know, I'm sure everyone has seen 50,000 versions of this. If you're an entrepreneur or investor, you know, does a company know what it's doing? You know, you start with your vision, like, why are you doing what you're doing? And every, you know, there's always variations on this, but, you know, why are you doing what you're doing? What is it that you're doing? How are you doing it? And sort of what's the public facing spin on what you're doing or in the positioning of what it ultimately is? Where culture fits into this is just sort of this, I like, you know, this is my fancy animation skills here. It's this amorphous cloud around all of this. The culture underlies this, culture results from this, but culture also influences this. It's just sort of the thing that both ties this all together and makes it all make sense and grounds it in the reality of the people you have who are going to make this happen. So kind of like I said, at the early days of Facebook, the culture was just the artifact of who we were, and who we were was a bunch of in college and just post-college people who were working on something fun. None of us had real corporate experience. The few people who did, it was out the window because this wasn't like anything they had worked on before, you know, and it was just this really fun social thing. It was a bunch of very smart people from elite universities, so we like to argue. There was having a 19-year-old, 20-year-old CEO, there's no notion that this guy just said it, so we're all just going to fall in line and listen to him. You know, that 19, 20-year-old's going to get a lot of pushback. And we're also hiring all these people who have strong opinions, strong personalities. This was going to be an argumentative, deliberative culture. This is also a culture of people who want to know everything. These are not people who you can give them assignment, they're head down with blinders on, they just give you their work and they don't ask, why am I doing this? They all want to be involved in the broader strategic framework. And lastly, it's a product that we're all using. So any decisions about that product are meaningful to us, not just because this is the company and we want the company to succeed. It's we're going to launch a feature and I'm going to use this feature, so it damn well better work the way I want it to work or I think it should work. And so that was sort of the organic aspect to it. And you can imagine a culture like that works great when you have, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, you know, even 100, even up to 200 people. We were still able to pull off a lot of that. Suddenly you get to 500 people and 1,000 people and having this culture where everyone knows everything and everyone is weighing in on everything, that starts to get a little top heavy, and you go back to that last list and you start to see some cracks in productivity, and you can even start to see cracks in alignment where if people, that last twist where you have the debate but everyone rallies around the decision that gets made, that gets a lot harder when you get more and more people, and also when the topics get bigger and bigger and the stakes get higher and higher. I'll never forget, it was, I think, late 2006, the first serious attempt to acquire Facebook. There was one attempt from Viacom, of all companies, who actually wanted to put Facebook, and this is Facebook was still a college-only website, they wanted to put Facebook in the MTV division, and it was, they had some weird idea that it was going to be this thing that was aligned with their more youthful properties within Viacom. That didn't get a lot of traction. Yahoo came waving $1 billion at the company at a time where that was a big number for Facebook. Mark did not want to say yes. Most of the co-founders did not want to say yes. Everyone else, including the employees, wanted to say yes. If we could do the math, and for those of us who were, you know, mid-20s, could do the math in our stock and be like, dude, say yes. Like, what are you doing here? You know, and the company actually did say yes. It's one of those things, if you study the history of the company actually did say yes. Yahoo then had a very bad earnings report and took a huge stock hit and had to lower their offer, which then made it easy for Mark to say no. But I'll never forget, you know, when that no finally happened, we'd have these all hands meetings with the companies. It's funny, later when I was running internal communications, I suddenly became in charge of these. But back then, they were just these informal things where kind of like everyone, you know, Mark would shout across the office, "Hey guys, we're having an all hands meeting," and everyone would just sort of crowd over to one part of the office. And he took the actual offer and stuck it on the wall and said, "Here's Yahoo's updated offer. Fuck that. We're not going to sell. We're doing this thing." And, like, you know, everyone kind of initially like, great. And then realizing, like, no, this is a good thing, and going with it. But it was around that time that we realized we actually have to think what matters to us. And the piece that actually stuck out the most, we actually knew these pretty early on, and those have actually been wildly consistent for Facebook's whole history. It was actually this piece that we sat down and realized why this company is important, what we're doing, and that it's becoming very ingrained in people's lives. What matters to us? Because what had been defining our culture was, we're young, we like to have fun, we can drink in the office, we have all this food, people are skateboarding, you know, every cliche of the Silicon Valley was being lived out in our office. And not because it was a cliche, it was just because we, you know, we were young and that's what young people do, I guess. But why are we doing this, and what really matters? And it was this exercise for Facebook that actually proved to be the most meaningful in terms of, okay, we are going to maybe not define what our culture is, but we're going to at least talk about what aspects of our culture actually matter versus what aspects are just an artifact of the people who are here. And that would prove incredibly meaningful, that as the company scaled, those were the things that we could latch on to. These are the things we want to preserve. These are the things we need to figure out how to preserve. Transparency was one of them. The idea that this was going to be a company that people could express their opinion, that people would disproportionately compared to other companies, understand the strategy, get an inside peek at what the company is actually doing. You know, not that there were no trade secrets or no kind of confidential products or things going on that people could know about, but to the best of its ability, the employees would be among the most informed people. You would never learn about something from the press that you didn't already know internally. One of my favorite anecdotes was after Sheryl Sandberg started, which was such a huge, I mean, this company was, it's still your dorm, by 2008, it was still your dorm room running, your dorm running the company, except now it was a company that was being valued at close to $1 billion and, you know, was hiring 50 people a week and was, you know, outgrowing offices and needed somebody to actually provide some organizational stability. And Sheryl Sandberg came at just the right moment. But I'll never forget her first Q&A. Facebook, since almost year one, has done these weekly Friday Q&As. They actually, I think they're live streaming today, as I heard, because the one leaked from a few weeks ago, the audio from one. And so I think today their reaction to it is Mark is live streaming his to the public. So you can actually listen to one of these. They're remarkably, other than Mark's answer, Mark's gotten very good at, he's much better at giving the public PR answer, whereas back in the day you could get some pretty raw answers out of him. But I'll never forget Sheryl's first Q&A. I think we were in the middle of one of the funding rounds. I don't remember which one it was. And someone at the Q&A just asked Mark of, how much cash does Facebook have on hand anyway? And Mark just sort of turned and looked and was like, I actually don't know the answer to that. You know, I could throw out a number, but I have no idea if it's right. And turned to the acting CFO at the time, who was in the first row, was like, you know, Sapora, do you know how much cash we have on hand right now? And she stood up and was like, you know, I think we have about, you know, cash, we have probably like $20 million, and then we have like $30 million in sort of short-term securities and another $50 million or so that's sort of liquid in a sense, but, you know, so somewhere you could probably say we have about $70 million in cash. And Sheryl just immediately jumps. I watch her because I was sitting near the front. I watch her eyes just getting huge. And she immediately jumps up. And this is when we got our first taste of, you know, here's the person who knows corporate speak to some extent, giving their impressions, going like, it is really great that this is a company where we can just at a Friday Q&A casually throw out how much cash the company has on hand. Let me tell all of you how incredibly sensitive that information is. And, you know, that's not a number that anyone outside of the company should know. That's really not a number anyone outside of the finance team really should know. So it's great that this is a thing, that this is a company able to talk about these things, and that understands the sensitivity of this stuff. And, you know, really, you know, all of us translating this, if we read any of this in one of the, you know, if TechCrunch reports on this number in an hour, I'm going to go apeshit on all of you and there will be blood. you know, realizing how unique that was and how important it was, and also Cheryl realizing, you know, what exactly is it that I just walked into here, and the challenges she was going to face trying to shepherd an organization that was so willy-nilly about stuff like that. And so, you know, as you think about, when you start thinking about how should I think about company culture, and again, getting back to that original example I talked about of our impression of Google at Facebook was this totally artificial, made up, their culture was part of their branding and it was being imposed, like, thou shall wear a silly hat around the office and thou shall, like, you know, do funny, you know, dress up for funny dress day and, you know, you shall ride a scooter around the office. That, you know, that sensitivity to where does the top-down influence start to become contrived and hit that negative place. Same time, that organic piece where it's coming from the bottom up, very genuine, very real, no issues there, but at what point does it become either counterproductive or is it not scalable or does it take on other types of liabilities? You know, our dorm room culture was great when the average age of the company was in their early 20s and we were all being silly. Not so great at a large company with people with a much broader set of cultural backgrounds, much different family circumstances, life circumstances. A lot of things we did back then would probably trigger lawsuits on a daily basis at a company like Facebook today. You know, that epic story, our 2006 holiday party, like, never going to forget that, of like, it was at Great American Music Hall in San Francisco that we actually, a music venue, we drank all their booze. That, like, that was our, like, the company's crowning achievement from the year is, like, we literally took all the booze the music venue had. They ran out. People had to, like, run to the liquor store across the street and bring beer and stuff back in because we had drunk all the music venue's beer. The stories the next day, you know, people waking up in weird places. I remember getting back to the office in Palo Alto and finding someone sort of randomly walking around the parking lot, like, blackout drunk, completely lost. The number of people who woke up in the office the next morning, the couple conference rooms that had been sullied in various ways. Amazing story, completely not scalable, terrible thing to have your culture be based on something like that because you're not going to be able to hold on to that. The scalability aspect is incredibly important when you think about this. Sheryl Sandberg, I remember, gave this great example, and I'm sure it's something she learned in business school. I wouldn't give credit to her for making it up, but credit to her because I heard it from her. She gives the most simple example, which is one of the worst things a small company can do is celebrate people's birthdays. Like, never do the office birthday cake thing because it's great when you have 20 people, but if your company is one that's meant to scale, when you hit 300 people even, certainly when you hit 1,000 people, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. And the worst thing you can do with culture is take something away. That this thing like, oh, it was so great, this company always celebrated people's birthdays, and now we're too big and we can't celebrate people's birthdays. We've lost our personality. We've lost our heart, you know. And so a really simple example, but that lesson teaches a lot, that if you define your culture around things that are not going to work, if you have 10, 20x the number of people, assuming your goal is to grow that way, you got to nip those early and you've got to understand what is the version of what you're trying to do that will grow with you. For me, taking on the internal communications role at Facebook, why it became a role was precisely that. This was a company that the linchpin of our culture was transparency and debate and everyone being involved in everything. That's just about the least scalable trait a company culture can have. And so our main focus on this team was how do we scale that? Because we cannot take that away. That will crush the company. You know, and credit to the company that even today as a 30, 50, 100,000 person company, it still has that, even under the restrictions of being a public company where, you know, that cash conversation, for example, is one that like literally can't happen at a public company or else you have to give that number to the public immediately because it's now an insider trading thing if you don't share that publicly. Even then, this internal communications group there today still is trying to figure out how do we navigate this, not just practical scalability. Now we have to deal with SEC law and the equivalent of SEC law in dozens of countries around the world. So really thinking about scalability is probably the most important thing when you think of these elements. Likewise, sustainability is also one to think about. The last one is one I want to touch on here, and then we'll get to questions because I know people have lots. This is one we figured out way too late in the game at Facebook, was this idea of biases, that if your culture unintentionally, or intentionally in some cases, but unintentionally puts off the wrong kind of people. In Facebook's case, like I mentioned, the average age of the company was people in their early 20s. The culture centered on a lot of social things, incredibly alienating to the few older employees we have, incredibly alienating to the younger employees who actually had gotten married young and had families. It's not a good thing when your company culture centers on being able to hang around after work and go to the bar and get wasted and, you know, come back to the office and snack all night. Not great if that's a key part of your culture when the people you need who are great contributors can't partake in that and really are put off by that. There's also a notion of positive biases that you want to think about, that having a culture that attracts the kind of people you want, but also maybe, I wouldn't say pushes away, but maybe doesn't feel like the right fit for the kinds of people you don't want. If you want a culture that is, for example, Uber is sort of the opposite of example of Uber had a culture that very much fomented sort of a cutthroat idea, and that was partially intentional. If they realized we're taking on industries that are very rooted in what they do, and we're taking on governments to some extent, we're heads down, full steam ahead. We're just going to barrel into these guys. This is not about cooperation and negotiation. This is, we're going to do what we're going to do. There was a cultural side to that that proved very negative. We saw it with, especially around gender equity issues, was kind of the place that got ugliest. But that culture attracted a kind of person that at scale caused a bunch of other problems that then the company had to clean up later on, you know, ultimately resulting in the CEO getting pushed out. There's a positive version of that, which is if you want a company that has a lot of heart, and that's more and more what you're seeing. If your brand story is about having a lot of heart, you need a culture that hits on that in ways that are genuine and real and aligned with that, and which will have a positive bias towards those kinds of people and a negative bias towards the kind of people you don't want, which is people who are gruff and cynical and who you just know, even if they're going to be a good contributor work-wise, they're going to be toxic for the environment. Having a culture that makes those people naturally sort of self-select out can actually be a really positive thing. So all of this, again, just back to this thesis of very much the criticalness of intentionality in all of this, that don't let culture just be what it is. Think about why are you doing what you're doing, even the silly little things, because if that's a silly little thing that's not going to grow with you, or if it's a silly little thing that you're not getting the full potential of it's actually aligned, it's something we could run with or tie into what we're doing in a more meaningful sense, really own those things. I guess I didn't get too much into the taking this in the hospitality world, but learning that it's all of these same lessons apply. What's funny is all of the little things we did at Facebook, none of those applied in hospitality. Getting people to drink the Kool-Aid has been the hardest part. And it's funny is in the hospitality world, it's the most important thing, because unlike the tech world, where in reality, most tech companies, a very small fraction of the employee base is disproportionately responsible for the value of the company. Everyone else plays a role largely in supporting those folks. But if you talk about, there's 10 people that if we lost those 10 people, we'd be dead in the water. Hospitality is the opposite of, just think about your experience at hotels and restaurants. Your main pinpoint is on the long tail people. You're dealing with a minimum wage waiter, a minimum wage kitchen staff who's making your food. And our success as a restaurant is entirely dependent on these people who also work at other restaurants and who naturally don't care what our broader story, we know we work on all this time branding and positioning. They don't care. They're just collecting a paycheck. how do we get them to care? Because that's the key to getting our brand story across. It turns out all these same lessons apply. You're just going from the different order where it's not about controlling a culture that is going to grow on its own. It's about cultivating and inspiring a culture that will not exist to begin with. But all of these same lessons, as it turns out, have applied, and we're just learning the hard way. You know, for me, it's going from a role where it was, how do I keep people from spinning their wheels and arguing incessantly about a topic and getting them, at the end of the day, just like, I get it, we've had the conversation, go respond to these users that you need to respond to, or, you know, go finish the financials for last week, which is actually what your day job is. So here it's one of, don't just be out there serving the food, you know, care about the bigger story. There's something here, you know, care about your coworkers. So it's been really interesting learning how these things differ in different environments. But all the same, even in that world, that trend is there, that people, even the hospitality world, they want meaning from their work. And so for all types of companies, more than anything, that's why you need to care about this, is that's how, if the job itself is not going to do that, and the reality is most jobs, the nature of the work just is never going to be fulfilling, because that, you know, serving someone a plate of food isn't necessarily going to be fulfilling. Answering an angry user that, I don't know how to upload this photo, what's it going? You know, that in and of itself is not necessarily fulfilling. You have to think of what is the bigger thing they're tapping into. And your company's culture is easily the most direct avenue for that. So a lot of information. I'm really good at just dumping lots of information, but I'll gladly take questions, anything about Facebook, what I'm doing now, any of this stuff. Happy to answer stuff.
Thank you. I'll give you this. Ezra, that was amazing. So much insight there. I love hearing about what you're doing with Arrive. Just to put it in perspective, you didn't really touch on this, but you've grown very, very quickly with Arrive. So I think you said 1,000 employees now. And
yeah. Like I mentioned, by the end of this year, we'll have 5 hotels open, and between the 5, a little over 1,000 employees. So it's, you know, in dramatically different geographic markets. But really interesting, that thing I mentioned about, you know, this is a workers' market, 0% unemployment. I mean, it's kind of always been a thing in the tech industry, especially workers, the talented workers have been calling the shots for a long time. It's crazy in the hospitality world. In a 0% unemployment world, we're now fighting for employees. There's an incredible shortage of kitchen staff across the country now. Where we have to think above and beyond, how do we get people in here? And it can't just be through compensation, because the math doesn't work. So we have to think, what are these other tools we have? And culture, like I mentioned, talking about being a leverage tool, in this case, it's leverage, because culture is pretty cheap in terms of an expense, you know, perspective. It's very hard from a time perspective. But culture, at the end of the day, is one of the only differentiators we have of, I can go be a waiter, a front desk agent, I can go do that anywhere. Why would I do that with you, especially if you're not going to pay me double what these guys are paying? Culture is almost the only tool we have to try to win those battles.
Amazing. I'm going to hand the microphone to John. We'll open it up to Q&A. A couple of housekeeping tips. One, I'm going to allow a little bit more time for Q&A, so we won't do announcements at the end. That way we can ask more questions. Also, this is a great time to ask about company culture, ask about the differences between Facebook culture and the early stages there and Arrive Hotel. Not a great time to give commentary on the year you started using Facebook or your political beliefs on you know, their culture. So here you go, John.
Hi, thanks. Great conversation, the starter, I think. I don't know what else to call it. It's just really interesting, your perspective. I'm just sort of thinking that my experience and what I've observed of many women who've, you know, kind of worked their way up in organizations is that basically then they just go and start their own companies, and that's happening in record numbers now, especially being surrounded by all men at the top and all their wives are working at home, and they get into a little thing talking about, you know, their cabins up at Big Bear, and you're like, okay, there's not a place for me here. And how much of that goes into your thinking when you're starting this new company, as well as when you were, it sounds like you had to transition through a lot at Facebook, through a transition of who was working at the company. How much do you think about, whether it's women or people of color, what their experience of the culture is?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's a term for it now. You know, we talk about equity and inclusion at this point. When Sheryl Sandberg started, the first issue she tackled, we didn't have that terminology in 10 years ago. It blows my mind, it's 10 years ago, but gender equity was far and away the biggest cultural problem at Facebook. That there were, it was, you know, like any tech company back then, it was disproportionately male. And because it was this argumentative culture, you know, it was very easy to see how the culture there could get in a direction that did feel alienating. There was also just bad optics of, you know, we had brought on Sheryl at the top, but the middle management was severely conformist, at least from a gender perspective. I mean, it's critical because, and again, more and more, it was sort of that idea of the loyalty aspect. One aspect I didn't touch on that is, one thing that's happened now is people are so much more open about their workplaces and they share about it publicly, that there's a risk mitigation aspect to this, which is if you have these negative cultural traits internally, they will get aired publicly. You're only going to be able to keep them in house for so long, especially if you're not addressing them. I mean, that's what happened at Uber. If you look at what happened there, the internal cultural issues had been simmering. It wasn't getting dealt with. And all of a sudden you had one main blog post got posted about it. And that triggered then a wave of follow-on people at the company just throwing the place under the bus, and it got out into the public. I think as far as people's expectations around companies, that company work environments are a reflection of society in some cases, people are now bringing those expectations into them, that, you know, this is not the military anymore. Top-down organizations still exist, but they are getting rarer and they're getting harder to justify and support. People do not feel like I should come. As soon as I walk in the company door, my political beliefs and my social beliefs have to get left there. They're bringing it in there with them. So I think when it gets to issues like that, you have to be open and you have to address it. And the only way to do it is to talk about it and have what are really hard, uncomfortable conversations, because stuff is going to come out that you didn't realize, and the people in charge are going to realize they've been hurting people or creating issues for people that they never meant to, and they're going to feel really bad about. And, you know, those conversations are really difficult. You can't avoid those anymore. And the earlier you address them when you're building a company, the better, and the more that you can ingrain that in your culture from day one, the better, because if you can make that a linchpin of your culture, that is actually incredibly scalable and will very much tie into that list of the sort of why do we do it? It's going to hit on all of these if you get those right. And conversely, you get those types of things wrong, all of these are going to very quickly become huge liabilities for you.
I really appreciate your topic, because I'm with a larger organization called Vistage, and we work with CEOs of businesses of all different sizes, and one of our mantras is culture trumps everything. I would really love to hear from you, because culture varies on whatever the industry is, whatever you're... So I'm curious what your large why is for these hotels that you're creating, and then how that then relates to the culture, and what is that culture, how do you define that culture, and then how it's operationalized?
So that, I mean, our brand story with the hotel is this neighborhood idea, like I talked about, that the hotel is a public space. And so the idea is create a space that is popular with locals, that's welcoming to locals, that locals are always hanging out at, and very naturally it becomes a spot for visitors. We give the, you know, I'm sure we're actually sort of making this up, but when I'm talking to investors, I talk about this story of, imagine, take whatever your stereotypical view of the old world village was, you know, and the social heart of the village would have been the pub, and the pub would have had rooms upstairs, and that's probably the closest thing to a hotel you would have had. And that idea that the hotel goes hand in hand with the pub, that the neighborhood's social, the village's social heart is also where the visitors stay. That's where stories are swapped, culture is swapped, all that happens. That's what we're trying to do. So the culture we want to build with employees, we want to tie into that, which is we want you to be very open with guests, interact with them. We want you to talk about what is it around, what is it that you love about this place? Our branding language is shifting to this idea of love of place, that why do we do this? Because we love this place, you know, and it's ambiguous. Do you mean the hotel, physically the four walls of the hotel? Do you mean this street, this neighborhood, this city? The answer is all of it. We love it. That's why we do this. We want to share this. We want to share our love for this with you. So that's the culture we're trying to instill, you know, and it's very similar in some respects to the Facebook culture of we love Facebook. You know, we love the idea that we're connecting the world, and we always used to talk about information flow, that we're increasing information flow around the world. Much easier, as it turns out, to get people to buy into that in the tech world, in the hospitality world, with, you know, minimum wage employees who are working multiple jobs. Again, could care less. What is this brand story? Trying to get, you know, the idea that it's a brand story doesn't mean anything to them. So how do we make the environment feel genuine enough and create a culture that feels caring enough that we're realizing the inroad to it there is get these people to care about each other. And I don't know how many of you have ever worked at a hotel or a restaurant. Generally, that's what sort of defines positive versus negative experience. More has to do with who are your coworkers. And so if you can get people to love their coworkers, we're realizing this love of place message then starts to resonate, because at least the I love the four walls of this place story will be there, and then the rest you can sort of train them on from there. But that's proven to be the challenge, is in industries that have never thought about culture as a real thing, and smaller workplaces that have never thought about it as a thing, it's show up, do the work, punch out, you know, and especially in a restaurant where it's are pretty regimented, especially kitchens can be very regimented and militaristic. That sort of creating heart turns out to be what we're seeing as the critical piece of this. And it's really hard, we're finding. But that's where we're focusing our effort now.
Ezra, over here.
Yep.
So you're touching on this a little bit, but all the giant workplace happiness studies in this country at Harvard and UC Riverside and Gallup show that the number one cause of happiness in the workplace is a sense of accomplishment. Hmm. Or you said meaningful work or making progress. Harvard calls it making progress. And then number two is autonomy. Those two things are actually fairly easy to achieve in tech. You can give people sense of accomplishment and autonomy. It seems like hospitality is the exact opposite.
Yes.
To get those two things. Are you implementing any specific programs or any actual hard policies to ensure that your employees are getting that?
Yes and no. Yes, and we're trying. No, and that we're not succeeding in that. We went into it. One of our original attributes that we went out with was this idea of cross-training, and some of it was actually efficiency. Our properties tend to be smaller, and so one of the business cases we made is how you make smaller hotels and restaurants work is you need to cross-train people because you need people to wear multiple hats, and it proved not to work, that it's just that the type of workforce you're dealing with that's just asking too much, and that you need to focus on getting them to do one thing really, really well. And back to that point of accomplishment, of make them feel really good that they are doing that one thing really, really well, but keep it focused. Autonomy is hard because there's really not room for that in the hospitality space. What's funny is I remember when we were looking at these kind of workplace happiness things, the one thing that you didn't mention that the studies we were looking at also really honed in. They honed in on those two things. The other element they really honed in on is the simplest predictor of whether somebody liked their job was whether they had a best friend at work. And that was the single most indicator of were they going to give positive or negative satisfaction scores. That question, do you have a best friend in the office or something along those lines, that actually turned out to be the best indicator of what their overall sense of the company was going to be. And so that's actually where we've chosen to focus. it also depends a little bit on kind of what the goals are. The challenges in the tech world as to what is it that you're sort of using culture to your advantage for is different in hospitality. In the tech world, there is an element of recruitment and training, but I think it is far more about productivity. The recruitment and retention, I think, tends to be a follow-on to the company itself is succeeding, and you've created an environment where people feel vested in what the company itself is doing. We're focusing more on that social side, that getting these people to care about each other and creating an environment where it feels like, just it feels like you're all on the same team. That's actually one of the hardest things that I hadn't thought about until it was way late in the game, is in a hospitality environment and a lot of types of companies, it is impossible to actually have everyone together at the same time, that people's schedules don't overlap at all. And it's literally physically impossible to actually do an all-hands meeting because somebody actually has to keep working. You can't actually stop what you're doing and have an event that involves everyone because you still have customers, you know, unless you're going to shut down the restaurant or shut down the hotel or whatever it is. And that's expensive and physically impossible at times. And so you have to think about, if you can't get everyone in the same room, that's the challenge of how do we create an environment full of people who care about each other. And that's why you actually see that being an issue in a lot of retail environments, of people don't care about each other because they haven't met half the people. They don't overlap with people. They don't see half the team. In restaurants, you always hear gripes between the closing staff and the opening staff. And it's, you know, these two groups who hate each other because they blame each other for everything the other side did, and they never meet and they never talk. And so it's figuring out, how do we create that sense of we're all on one team here, is where we're focusing in hospitality.
Okay. Well, we normally end Q&A at 9:30, but since you're providing a lot of really great information, if anybody has time constraints, we'll let you leave, but please do so quietly. And we're just going to go with one more question.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Jody Maneri. For context, I work in brand strategy. I would absolutely love to hear your perspective on how to retain culture when a company either brings in outside funding or transitions to be a public company, and especially if you have any specific tactics that you've seen people use that are effective.
I think one of the main things is figuring out, if you haven't done these culture exercises before and your culture hasn't been intentional to date, it's that analysis of, you know, back to my amorphous cloud of culture. What is this cloud for our company? And really differentiating between what are the tokens of it versus what's the actual deeper thing. Like, because a lot of times people latch on to, well, it's that we go out to lunch once a week, or it's, you know, we have these fun parties, or this X, Y, and Z, where it's like that thing itself isn't really the culture. That's sort of the manifestation of it. Like, what underneath it is actually the thing that matters? And really trying to tease that piece out. Ideally, it's something that actually does tie into the brand story. I mean, the issue is if it doesn't, then you have these sort of integrity issues of, this is feeling contrived, this doesn't feel genuine, this isn't real, this is BS. And culture is very resistant to BS and very good at calling it out. It tends not to survive. You know, what you can get away with branding out to the public, internal branding, if it mismatches people's reality, is going to get called out really fast and be very stark. So I think it's that process more than anything, is really getting back to what matters again. You know, and again, it can go hand in hand with, as part of the branding exercise, I'm sure you're going through whatever your version of this is, you're going through that. It's during that process is the time to address it, because if you create this and you haven't figured out what this amorphous cloud is, you're creating a risk of misalignment or challenges to the integrity of this, which is the last thing you want. Beyond that, I think it's pretty unique to each company, that it really depends on the people there and what they care about and what are the challenges from an HR perspective. I mean, what's interesting is culture tends to get shoved into the realm of HR, which is sort of the right place for it to be monitored. HR tends to be the worst place to actually drive this because their incentives are very different and tend to be defensive more than anything. You want this driven by leadership, maybe with HR there to, and police might be the wrong word, but to shepherd it into ways that are sustainable and scalable and, you know, compliant and legal, right?
The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory. Learn more about how Echo Factory can help your business achieve rapid, sustainable growth at echo-factory.com. And get all the details about upcoming Friday Coffee Meetup episodes at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.